VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the frantic search for survivors of a sinking South Korean ferry. The Chinese economy slows in the first quarter. France pushes for a Syrian referral to the ICC. Marking the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings, and more millennials are unplugging to embrace board games.
It's very interesting for spending quality time together, so that's why I like it.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. South Korean officials say several people have died and at least 290 are missing after a ferry sank off the country's southern coast today. The boat was carrying more than 459 people, mostly students, to the resort island of Jeju when it sank in what appeared to be calm conditions. Many are feared to be trapped inside the submerged ship or stranded in the surrounding waters, which were only 12 degrees Celsius. Dozens of helicopters and ships, including a U.S. Navy amphibious assault vessel, are involved in the massive search and rescue effort. South Korean Navy SEALs are searching the sunken vessel, but officials warn that those trapped inside may not have survived. Survivors were taken to the nearby island of Jindo. Many of the passengers said they were initially told to stay in their seats and do not try to escape. Chinese officials say economic growth for the world's second largest economy slowed in the first quarter of this year. Economists are warning that the downward trend could continue as China seeks to transform its economy with market-based reforms. VOA's Bill Ide has details from Beijing.
China's National Bureau of Statistics says economic growth in China during the first quarter slipped to its slowest pace in 18 months. Bureau spokesman Sheng Liyun says the growth rate of 7.4% is a reflection of China's efforts to transform its economic model. He says the figures were still within the range the government expects, and that there are already signs of progress in the government's efforts to reform the economy. Sheng adds, however, that at the same time, the complexities of the global economy continue to put downward pressure on the Chinese economy. He says that looking forward, persistent efforts are needed to oversee the rollout and implementation of government policies. Some economists saw reason for optimism in the figures released Tuesday, noting that industrial production picked up in March and that retail sales were slightly better than expected for the first quarter. Others predict the slowing of the Chinese economy will continue. Andrew Batson of GK Dragonomics in Beijing says seasonal factors can make first quarter growth seem to be especially weak, and that the economy may pick up from its current pace. But more broadly, he says, it's likely the government will not reach its goal of 7.5% for this year.
Growth is going to slow this year pretty much regardless of what the government does. If they can avoid that growth slowdown, like turning into kind of negative spiral and keep spirits high among private sector companies, then I don't think the growth slowdown has to be disastrous, but that depends a lot essentially on their ability to deliver politically.
Late last year, China unveiled sweeping reforms aimed at letting the market have more sway in the economy. But some economists say their rollout is taking too long. The changes are hoped to make the economy more efficient by opening up more sectors to competition from private and foreign enterprises. Song Hong, an economist at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, says China's economy still has huge potential. But government measures to address problems such as local government debt, graft, and the country's red-hot property market have had a dampening effect on the economy. Song says that from the time the new government stepped into office, it has taken a more cautious approach to the economy as it has taken steps to avoid the problems of the past, such as corruption and inefficiencies. He says the government has yet to fully utilize some of the potential of the Chinese economy to open up more opportunities for development. Song says that could come in the form of investment in public infrastructure projects, the loosening of credit, and a wide range of restrictions, including those on the purchase of homes. The Chinese government has already announced sub-measures to boost growth, such as investment in railway projects and tax cuts for small firms. They are also speeding up efforts to improve slum areas, known as shanty towns, where tens of millions of poor Chinese live. However, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang says China will not use any major short-term stimulus measures to fight short-term dips in the country's economic growth. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
President Barack Obama begins a week-long trip to Asia next Tuesday in a bid to reassure allies in the region. Mr. Obama will travel to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
China is not on the itinerary, but with its efforts to control parts of the East and South China Sea, Beijing is on the minds of Mr. Obama and allies he is visiting. U.S. military cuts are making regional partners nervous about Washington's commitments to defend them. Analyst Bruce Klingner.
I'm confident President Obama will give bold rhetoric reassuring our allies that we can still run as fast and jump as high. But whether they believe that will be the other issue. But our allies, like our opponents, can read a budget balance sheet just as easily as the rest of us in Washington can.
President Obama will stop in Japan, Malaysia, and the Philippines, nations that have ongoing territorial disputes with China. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has just been to China and has said the U.S. does not view Beijing as an enemy. But the administration sees the country, with its growing military, as a potential threat. Washington's decision to not attack Syrian forces or provide significant military support to Ukraine have raised questions about whether the U.S. would step in to defend its Asian allies. Eli Ratner is an Asia analyst with the Center for Indo-American Security.
There's been obviously a lot of talk about questions about the power and influence of the United States vis-a-vis actions in Syria and the Ukraine. But we'll see. This effort is clearly meant to send the message that the United States remains committed and strong in Asia.
That message is especially important to Japan, the U.S.'s main ally in the region, and where the president will make his first stop. There, Mr. Obama will work to speed up negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Regional Trade Agreement. Trade is also on the agenda at his next stop, South Korea, where he will discuss North Korea and try to ease relations between Seoul and Tokyo. They are strained by the memory of Japanese atrocities in the first half of the 20th century. Mr. Obama will be the first U.S. president to visit Malaysia since 1966. The last stop is the Philippines, where the U.S. closed its permanent bases decades ago, but has been in negotiations to rotate troops, airplanes, and ships into the country. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The United Nations says widespread corruption, propaganda, and misinformation are to blame for escalating tensions in Ukraine. In a report released Tuesday, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights calls for perpetrators of rights violations to be held accountable for their actions. Lisa Schlein reports from the UN in Geneva.
The United Nations report looks at the root causes of the crisis facing Ukraine. It blames current disquieting events in the country on widespread corruption and economic inequality, on lack of accountability for human rights violations by security forces, and on a weak rule of law. The UN Human Rights Office says protests in November in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, which were largely peaceful, turned violent and became radicalized because of the excessive use of force by the Berkut Special Police and other security forces. The report says 121 people, mainly protesters, died during the demonstrations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As part of its effort to refer the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court, France presented graphic images Tuesday from the so-called Caesar report of individuals allegedly tortured, starved, and killed by the Syrian government. VOA's Margaret Bashir has details from the UN in New York.
Nearly 60 countries have demanded that Syria be referred to the court in The Hague, but it is up to the majority in the UN Security Council to decide to send it there. The council has been very divided over the Syrian crisis, and the Russians and Chinese have previously blocked other resolutions related to the situation. They could veto any effort to refer Syria to the ICC. French Ambassador Gerard Araud told reporters his government is going to try to persuade all council members to support a referral.
It will be to the ICC to investigate everything and to decide on every crime committed in Syria by the regime. I have said it several times. We are not politicizing. It's not a charge against the regime. It's all the crimes committed, and crimes are also committed by the opposition.
At the news conference with the French ambassador were two members of the team of legal and medical experts that studied the 55,000 photographs of 11,000 bodies smuggled out of Syria by a former sergeant in the Syrian military police. Earlier Tuesday, the experts briefed members of the Security Council. Their job was to give an opinion on the credibility of the man who was given the code name Caesar and on the authenticity of the pictures. David Crane is the former first chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. He told reporters it is rare to receive such a cache of what they determine to be credible evidence.
In our business, we rarely have direct, specific, photographic and written evidence of crimes against humanity, war crimes, or genocide. Most of these thugs don't write this stuff down.
Crane and his colleague, British forensic scientist Stuart Hamilton, showed a series of disturbing and graphic photos of corpses that had endured horrific torture, including what appeared to be brutal beatings, chemical burns, bruises, strangulation, and starvation. Hamilton said there are few reasons an individual would have such injuries unless the intent was to inflict pain.
I have not seen much like this in my career, and I can think of no natural or innocent explanation as to how someone could come to look like this.
The investigators said Caesar did not receive any compensation for the photographs and that he put himself at great personal risk over a two-year period to copy the pictures and then smuggle them out of Syria. Before the Syrian conflict began in March 2011, Caesar had worked for 13 years as a crime scene photographer for the Syrian military police. After 2011, he was assigned to photograph corpses at a military hospital that received bodies from three detention centers in the Damascus suburbs. Working through another individual, he was eventually smuggled out of Syria last year in an elaborate ruse that included faking his own death. A handful of the pictures were first made public in a British newspaper in January as the government and opposition were meeting in Geneva in a bid to end the conflict. Those talks ended in failure. The investigation was funded by the Arab Gulf state of Qatar, which has supported the opposition in the Syrian crisis, leading to some skepticism about the credibility of the photographs. The Syrian government has dismissed the Caesar report as politicized. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden says the one-year anniversary of the deadly bombings at the Boston Marathon is not just an important day for survivors, but an important day for the entire United States. The two bombs, which authorities say were planted near the marathon finish line by ethnic Chechen brothers Tamerlan and Jokhar Tsarnaev, killed three people and wounded more than 250 others on April 15, 2013. Mr. Biden spoke Tuesday in Boston at an anniversary ceremony.
And next Monday, on Patriots Day, when I'm told up to 36,000 people line up to start the marathon, you will send a resounding message around the world, not just to the rest of the world, but to the terrorists, that we will never yield. We will never cower.
America will never, ever, ever stand down. We are Boston. We are America. We respond. We endure. We overcome. And we own the finish line.
The attack last year set off a multi-day manhunt that ended with Tamerlan Tsarnaev dead from a shootout with police and a bloody Jokhar being arrested in a Boston suburb. Jokhar is due to go on trial in November on 30 federal charges and will face the death penalty. The Boston Marathon is one of the most prestigious in the world and has been held every year since 1897. This year's race features an expanded field of runners, about 9,000 more than in 2013. The field includes several thousand runners who started last year's race but were unable to finish because of the bombings. Organizers have boosted security with cameras installed along the route and thousands of police and hundreds of National Guard troops set to be deployed in the area. Americans last week dealt with another seemingly unprovoked school attack, this one by a Pittsburgh student with two kitchen knives. New York theatergoers have a chance to explore the emotions surrounding these events. The Library, a new play at New York's Public Theater, unfolds after a school shooting and peers into the shattered lives of survivors and the stories they tell. The play is directed by Oscar winner Steve Soderbergh and written by Scott Z. Burns, who has worked with Soderbergh on three films before they turned their attention to the stage. Jeff London reports.
Even before the play begins, Soderbergh and Burns make the audience uneasy. When you enter the theater, a young woman in a hospital gown lies center stage on what could be a table or a bed or a slab in the morgue, says playwright Scott Z. Burns.
People start having to invent a story, you know, which is she alive? Is she not alive? And so they're already, before we've said anything, experiencing what the play is about, which is, you know, you start assembling facts and truths into stories that support your belief set and allow you to keep going.
Once the play starts, the audience discovers that the young woman on stage is a high school sophomore named Caitlin Gabriel. And although she survived a violent massacre, one of the other survivors has gone on TV and accused her of telling the gunman where several victims were hiding. 17-year-old film actress Chloe Grace Moretz is making her stage debut as Caitlin.
And so Caitlin Gabriel wakes up out of her induced coma, basically. And she finds out right then and there that not only is her best friend that she was laying beside dead, but that she is now being accused of being an accomplice to the murder of six children and one faculty member.
Then he went over to these two girls. I think he recognized one of them, Caitlin Gabriel, and they started talking. He asked her where the others were hiding, and she said the AV closet. They're in the AV closet.
As the characters attempt to untangle the truth, each of them, kids and parents, try to control the narrative, often publicly, on television and in newspapers. Director Steven Soderbergh has seen that happen after real massacres.
We were fascinated by not only the idea of competing stories that have to do battle, but also another story or another myth that often comes out of events like these is that somehow everyone who goes through a tragedy is somehow ennobled by it if they survive. And we were interested in sort of proposing a more realistic version of that story, which is some people that go through tragedies like this are just damaged.
It was the story of one survivor of the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado that prompted Scott Z. Burns to write the play. He recalls that shortly after the massacre, in which two students killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher, misinformation about some of the victims and survivors began to proliferate.
And so when stories get out, you know, especially now when we have a lot of unfiltered media that finds its way into our eyes and ears very quickly after these things, it's hard to get it back.
Actress Chloe Grace Moretz puts it even more simply.
It's like the whisper game you'd play at camp, you know, where one person whispers at the other end of the table and then they all whisper the same thing, and by the end of it, you find out it's a completely different story.
Hey, Brett, look, are you ever gonna call me back? I just talked to the police and, God, you didn't tell me you talked to them too. I wish you would have told me that. Can't you just come over?
The playwright and director choose not to focus on the gunman. If there's an antagonist in the story, it's the mother of one of the victims, who deals with her loss by writing a book and consulting on a film, both of which sanctify her daughter and accuse Caitlin of leading the gunman to other victims.
I don't want to hear it from the paper, Katie. I want to hear it from you. I need to know your story.
My story.
What happened? From your perspective.
But you told the police.
Okay. Well, I remember he asked me if I knew who he was, and I thought he was worried about being identified, so I said no, even though I did.
I see. You were trying to protect yourself?
Yeah,
Of course she was.
And that meant telling him where the others were hiding.
No. No, I don't remember saying that.
Throughout the play, as new information about the characters and events is revealed, director Steven Soderbergh says audience members begin to question their own beliefs.
The story sort of comes at you in waves, you know what I mean? Like we experience the news cycle. Sort of every scene, there's another shoe that drops and you go, oh boy, now I have to rethink what I've been watching.
The posters for the library say the play is based on future events. Unfortunately, as recent events have illustrated, that may prove all too true. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Lin Yang.
I'm Aisha Holly.
And I'm Madeline Eck.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Beginning April 28th for the Voice of America's Now.
A big new trend in the U.S. toy industry has more consumers switching off their high-tech gadgets to play with classic toys like board games. This is especially true among the so-called millennial generation, those born in the 1980s and 90s. Elizabeth Lee has more from an unusual cafe in Los Angeles, where the new trend is popular and business is booming.
Unlike many cafes, the food and drinks here are just an afterthought, and there is no Wi-Fi. Many of the customers like it that way.
I think it's very interesting for spending quality time together, so that's why I like it.
Roxanne Lee and her husband, Agassiz Lai, are at Game House Cafe, an establishment dedicated to board games like this one.
You keep rolling dice and try to move to different places and try to escape the temple.
Lai turned from video games to board games a few years ago.
I would choose board game over video game any day.
Lai and most customers here are so-called millennials, between 18 to 32 years old. Market research firm Euromonitor International says this demographic is driving sales in the U.S.
I think more with my generation, they're wanting to take time, they're wanting to take it slowly. And I think, too, you know, video games have kind of lost their glamour.
These consumers are not playing the classic American games they grew up with. They're playing new games, many of them require strategy, like this one.
Because of the rise of European games, or Euro games, or German games, as they might also be known in the last 15 to 20 years, it's actually become sort of universal. There are certain titles that have really crossed a lot of cultures to really capture the imaginations of different people.
Game House Cafe co-owner Terry Chu says these so-called Euro games are popular because they are not language-based and use symbols and simple rules. In the next year, Euromonitor International expects global sales of board games and puzzles to grow by more than 1%. Still no match for video game sales, which are expected to grow 6%. While many millennials, such as Christy Nimi, play video games, they say high-tech games lack one element board games offer.
The more personal aspect of just being with friends and seeing each other in person, and, you know, that's probably the main difference and the main appeal.
Everyone's life is so engaged in technology, but there's a time where you want to put down that phone, you want to put down that tablet.
And connect face-to-face with other people. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Astronomers around the world are hoping a newly released image from the far reaches of our solar system is the never-before-seen birth of a new moon. NASA's spacecraft Cassini, in orbit around the Saturn, sent a photo of a bright protrusion on the edge of one of the planet's outer rings. It may be a gravitational disturbance caused by a small moon tentatively named Peggy. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History.
On April 16th, 73 AD, the Great Jewish Revolt came to an end when Roman troops successfully ended the three-year stand by the Zealots at Masada. On this day in 1521, Protestant reformer Martin Luther arrived in the German city of Worms to make an appearance before the Diet, or General Assembly of the Holy Roman Empire. When asked to denounce his writings, Luther proclaimed, "I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience." The Diet declared Luther a heretic and called for his arrest. On this day in 1917, the leader of Russia's Bolshevik Party, Vladimir Lenin, returned from exile to Petrograd, modern-day St. Petersburg, to organize a revolt against the weak post-Tsarist provisional government. On this day in 1947, former presidential advisor Bernard Baruch used the term Cold War to describe relations between the United States and Russia. Instantly embraced by newspapers, the term was an apt description for the battle between the two ideological foes. And in this week of 1969, Desmond Dekker and the Aces with their Jamaican sound rose to the top of the British charts with The Israelites.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Call me Israelite, sir. Get up in the morning, saving.
Before the ascent of Bob Marley, Desmond Dekker was one of the most popular musicians within Jamaica and one of the best-known Jamaican-style musicians outside of it. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian government continues to cut the Russian people off from independent voices and from media perspectives that differ from the state's controlled narratives. Most recently, Russian authorities have stopped Voice of America's radio broadcasts in Moscow, thereby silencing the last vestige of U.S. international radio broadcasting in the country. In a one-sentence letter, the director of Russia's information agency, Russia Svodnya, or Russia Today, Dmitry Kiselyev, announced that we are not going to cooperate with the request by VOA's parent agency, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, to continue a long-standing contract for broadcasting on Russian soil. The Broadcasting Board of Governors condemned the decision. In a statement, BBG Chairman Jeff Shell noted that Russian media, including RT Television, enjoy open access to the airwaves in the United States and around the world. The Russian people deserve the same freedom to access information. The U.S. Embassy in Moscow noted in a statement that the silencing of VOA is the latest effort by Russia to decrease space for independent and free media in the country. In the last year, the Russian government has passed laws imposing unprecedented censorship and restrictions on media and online publications. In the past few months alone, it has blocked independent websites and blogs, denied visas and accreditation to foreign professional journalists, and forced leadership changes at several media outlets simply because those outlets dared to challenge the Kremlin's extremist policies. In addition, the embassy said, not only has the Russian government ignored harassment, attacks, death threats, and kidnappings of journalists in Russia and Crimea, it has made no progress in prosecuting the murders of several other journalists, including American journalist Paul Klebnikov and Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. The United States supports the fundamental right of all Russians to exercise their freedoms of expression and assembly, rights enshrined in the Russian Constitution, as well as in international agreements to which Russia is a party. The U.S. calls on the Russian government to respect those rights it has committed to protect.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.